हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनभुनक्तु सह वीर्यंकरवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरिगौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, bottom of 21. The Padma Puran reiterates this point. Diksha mantras received from acharyas coming in the line of a bona fide disciplic succession have full spiritual potency. Others are impotent and cannot give any spiritual benefit. It means they may give the mantras by chanting it as pious, so you may get pious credits for it, but you won't get devotional credits for it. There are four bona fide sampradayas, the Sri Sampradaya, also known as the Lakshmi Sampradaya, the main acharya being Sri Ramanuja, the Brahma Sampradaya, the main acharya being Sri Madhva, the Rudra Sampradaya, the main acharya being Sri Vishnu Swami, and the Chatushana Sampradaya, also known as the Sanaka Sampradaya, the main acharya being Sri Nimbarka. These four Vaishnava Sampradayas are the liberators of this world. Of these, the Brahma Sampradaya is the oldest. The unbroken chain of successive spiritual preceptors continues until this day. The foolproof process of Guru Parampara Sampradaya ensures that the knowledge and words of all the prime ancient scriptures of yore, such as the Vedas, Vedanga, and Vedanta, remain complete and in their original form without interpolation or change. Right? Interpolation means something's been added by someone else. Hence, all the Vedic mantras contained in the literatures of the bona fide Sampradayas are undoubtedly authentic. In this way, the system of Sampradaya, which is is unbroken line of perfect acharyas, is imperative. And since time immemorial has remained a most dynamic and indispensable element of the society of saintly souls. Rajanath. In the first Dasamul Shloka, the Vedas are declared as the only praman, pratyaksha pramana, the evidence from direct perception, has been relegated to the position of being a subordinate praman of the Vedas. However, in the philosophical schools of Nyaya and Shankya, etc., there is a large group of pramanas. Even the followers of the Puranas have enumerated at least eight pramanas. Pratyaksha, direct perception, anuman, inference, upamana, analogy, shabda, knowledge revealed through sound, atitya, traditional knowledge, anupalabde, knowledge deduced from the non-perceived, artapati, derivative knowledge, and sambhava, probability. Why are there conflicting views on this point? Furthermore, if pratyaksha, direct perception, and anuman, inference, are not acknowledged as principal pramanas, how is knowledge to be communicated and perceived? Kindly make me understand this point. Right? Because so now they've established the paramparas, he's accepted that point, because he didn't ask a question on that. But now, because the concept of parampara is there, they don't have a problem with that. All these lines have their paramparas. Problem is they don't go back to Brahma, Shiva, Lakshmi, or the four Kumaras. Right? You said they'll have somebody somewhere where started something, it comes down. And so this concept of having a teacher and he has a teacher, so the longer and older it is, the more kind of puffed up they are about it. Right? So for the materialist, the idea that there's this line, it's considered good, you know, like that. So, but here now he's asking, is that in Praman, in evidence, then the Vedas given is the only evidence. Right, so shabda means out of pratyaksha, anuman, and shabda. Only shabda is said to be that is evidence. So now this Vrajanath is asking, but in the lines of Nyaya, Shankya, and these other lines, they accept these other aspects also. And not only that, the Puranas give 8 different varieties of things, right? And so, like that, then why is it these are neglected? Right? So. Yes. Does that make sense? So he immediately thinks there's something conflicting, right? Because because if you're looking at things external, if somebody's saying Nyaya says there's 4, and then but everybody accepts at 3, right? But he says the Puranas say 8, right? But you're only saying 1. So why is this is a contradiction rather than. Then it's just, expanding and contracting on the same points, right? Raghunath Das Babaji. Pratyaksha, Anuman, etc. are sentient pramanas, entirely dependent upon sense perception, right? Because the pratyaksha means direct sense perception, right? And Anuman means you're seeing 2 out of 3 things that can be perceived with the senses. And then what's missing, by the logic, you're connecting them together. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. However, the senses of the jiva are imperfect because of the 4 innate shortcomings. Brahma, the tendency to be illusioned. Pramada, the tendency to make mistakes because of illusion and inattention. Vipralipsha, the tendency to cheat. And karanapattava, the limitations of inadequate and imperfect senses. Right? Means the senses themselves are imperfect, right? So they're not necessarily pulling in anything. Now, whatever they're pulling in is being dealt with by the mind, right? The mind chooses what to look at. As we mentioned, thousands and thousands of sense perceptions are coming in at every moment. And then from that, we choose one, right? Because the mind can only deal with one thing at a time. Right? Does that make sense? It may be able to move back and forth between many things, but it's only dealing with one at a time. Right? So then, the difficulty then comes is that because we're conditioned, then we tend to be illusioned, we tend to be inattentive, we tend to cheat. Right? So now you already have a sense that's not pulling in necessarily the perfect information. And then on top of that, we cheat and we're illusioned. Right? Does that make sense? So it's not going to work out so good, right? Has it worked out, right? The modern academies, we know it's like 1,000 years old, right? Like that. I think it's, a little less. They're all established like in, I think, the early 1100s, like that. Oxford, I think there was a place in France, Bologna, like that. It's funny how in America, if something's considered bogus, you say it's baloney. Whatever. Yeah. But whatever. Bologna is the leading academy in the Western academic field, right? Means if you have this concept, we have bachelor, master's, and PhD, that's from Bologna. Because previously everybody else only did 2. You did a bachelor's, which was 6 years instead of 4. And then you did a PhD, which then happened to be a bit longer than, a few years also. Traditionally about 12. Right? So, like this. And then just slowly, slowly now it's starting to change the modern concept. They have these 3 levels. So it comes from there. So they have great feelings of, we've been here a long time. Right? So the problem is they still haven't worked out that we're not the body, that we're the soul, right? That there's a creator. That means they would have, 1,000 years ago, they would have believed that there's God. But now they officially can't state that on campus, So it's not getting better, it's getting worse. Right? So that's why now he's pointing out that, okay, the reason that Pratyaksha Anuman and all that is not counted as the Praman, you know, Shastra is given as the Praman, is because it depends upon your senses and mind. So if you're going to start there, you're already starting with something faulty. Right? That's the difficulty. Consequently, how can knowledge or information communicated through these imperfect senses be accurate and authentic? It is, however, the great spiritual preceptors and wise sages deeply absorbed in meditation that have received the absolutely perfect knowledge in the form of the Vedas, revealed to them by the omnipotent and fully independent Supreme Person, who personally appeared in their hearts. In this way, this flawless knowledge is accepted from the Lord without the disturbances caused by the limitations of the material senses. If knowledge acquired through the evidences of Pratyaksha Anuman, etc., correspond with the perfect teachings of the Vedas, then, of course, we are duty bound to accept such evidences. Consequently, the self-perfected Vedas, supported by the subordinate Pratyaksha evidence, are the only true evidence. Okay, so you caught what happened here? In other words, if the knowledge perceived by the senses is in line with the Veda, it's also accepted as bona fide, and we're duty-bound to accept that, because it's in line with the Veda. But to start with it on its own without the Veda, that is not done. That's not appreciated, right? Yes.
Does that mean applied Vedic knowledge? I mean, when you say...
Yeah, you could say it's applied, because you have the knowledge and you're going to have to apply it, so that means you have to be able to see it through your senses. In other words, the proper thing is you take the Veda, the knowledge there, and when you can apply that so you see it in your life, that's the actual proper application. Right? Like that. That's what you want to get to. But it has to start from Veda. If it doesn't start from Veda, it's not considered proper. In other words, the other ones are supporting evidence, and we accept them as evidence as long as they're in line with the Veda. But we never start there. Right? We never start there. So much of the time that we see is we give something. Okay, here. Hey, pratyaksha, okay, direct perception, anuman, inference. Okay, upamana, analogy. Okay? So then we're giving an analogy, comparing something to something. So it may be the comparison is good. It may be the person has taken the proper aspect you want from the analogy, and maybe they didn't. Right? Does that make sense? Like so many times we're discussing something, and we give an example, right? And then the questions start to run along the example, not around the point being made. Yeah. You know? So that's the problem, is sometimes it doesn't work out so good. Shabda, knowledge received through sound, like you hear something, right? You know? A twig cracks, so then you think, oh, something's there, and it's moving. Otherwise, it had to step on the twig, that for a crack, there's something there. Right, and depending upon where you are, if you're in Africa, it might be a lion. You know, if you're in the south, you know, I mean, whatever it is, it might be so many different things. Okay, like that. You know, if you're on the North Pole, then it's probably a polar bear. Problem is there's no twigs, so then you know, you've had a slight disadvantage there. You know, so through sound, then you hear things and you think, oh, this was something. But problem is, you know, the car backfires, you think a shot was fired. Mm-hmm. You know, so many different things are there. People come up with all kinds of strange things. Mm-hmm. Okay. Aitikya, traditional knowledge. So the traditional knowledge, it's not that the tradition is a problem, because smriti means tradition. The problem is again, goes back to our senses and mind. We're illusioned. We tend to cheat. So we think, oh, well, you can adjust it like this, and then that's been adjusted, then the next generation adjusts, and then you say, no, but it's tradition, but it's not tradition anymore. You know, maybe some external form is, but everything else is kind of gone. Mm. Like, remember how you say? Was in one, you know, really kind of wealthy, wedding in Bombay, like that. You know, all devotees, like that, and like that. And so then the ladies, because in India, because it means if you tie your hair, then you're Indian, right? So you don't want to be Indian, so you have to be Western, modern, so you have to leave your hair open. right? Even though Western ladies will tie their hair, especially at a wedding and formal ceremonies. It means they all tie their hair, right? You know, like that. But they won't. So, but the thing is, tradition is hair is tied. So they would take a couple of strands of hair from the front, right? And then tie them in the back, right? The rest of it's all open. So they're following tradition. You understand? That's the problem. Okay, anupalabdhe, knowledge deduced from the non-perceived. So what's not there, then you think, okay, everybody's here, but this guy's not here, and this guy's a doofus, and he's always not here, so he must be doing some other crazy, stupid thing. So you're going through all that by what's not there. But it may be he's not doing that. You know, you understand? Derivative knowledge. Okay, is knowledge derived from something? You know, it means it's already, the stocks are already an illusion, and then the derivatives are even more of an illusion. Anybody knows what that means, right? It's not even there, you know, you're trading in stocks that, you know, it's something that doesn't even exist, you know. Okay.
It would be
verbal cognition.
Yeah, basically. But the thing is it's working. People are buying, right?
You know? Or not.
Yeah, and probability, what could happen? Oh, but then if we do this, that might happen, and this might happen. So if it's all based on shabda, it has some meaning, but if it's not, so many times, this is there, that'll happen. Okay, fine, but what's it based on? But the devotees don't necessarily take it back to shabda. So therefore, it's based on the imperfect senses. So then it's a matter of, you know, then it's a matter of false ego. Why, you think my senses are less imperfect than your senses? Or your senses are so much less imperfect than my senses? You know, like that kind of test. Okay. So, consequently, the self-perfected Veda supported by the subordinate pratyaksha evidence are the only true evidence. So in other words, Veda is the true evidence, and you're going to apply that in your life, because that was his question before. Okay, Veda is there, but even we're going to discuss it, I have to discuss it through the senses, right? And I'm going to, you know, have to, you don't understand, I'm going to have to give an analogy, I'm going to have to give so many things to let you understand. So how will we do that if Veda is the only evidence? So he's saying, no, the others are evidence as long as they're in line with the Veda. Right? Then it's fine, then it's perfect. Vrajanath, the Vedas comprise innumerable texts, which are bona fide and which are not. Raghunath Das Babaji, in the course of time, many unscrupulous men have interpolated chapters, mandalas, sections, and mantras into the Vedas for self-interested reasons, like that. A Vedic text may be discovered somewhere, but that does not mean that all parts of the book are authentic. Texts that have been authenticated through the ages by the acharyas of the bona fide sampradayas are the Vedas. Sections or even entire books rejected by these authorities are unacceptable to us. So sometimes the acharyas, they say that this is there, this part's not. Like I think when Madhvacharya, he wanted to do, I think, a commentary on Mahabharata. So, but at the time, at least in his area, there were 40 different texts. Right, so he had them all sit down at once and read them simultaneously, and then listening for a while, he says, "That's the one." But, you know, so he's good. I mean, he used to write 6 books at once. You know, he'd have 6 people because you had to write, you know, on the text. So he'd have 6 scribes there. And he'd say the first verse to the first one. Then he'd say the first verse of the second book to the second scribe. The first verse of the third book to the third scribe. Like this, when you get to the sixth, then you go back and do the second verse. Because you need time for the ink to dry. Right? So then sixth was like...
That's good.
Yeah, he was good. Jiva Goswami used to also, because you're writing on the pages, and because it has to dry, you can't turn it over. So he'd write the first verse, and then he'd write the third verse. And then when it dried, turn it over, do the second and the fourth.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, so when we say these were scholars, we mean these were scholars, you know, like that. And this is just, they're just composing like that. It's not they're sitting down there and they got the rough draft and wad that up and throw it in the corner. You got a palm leaf. You can't wad it up, you know, like that. So they just, in the mind, compose it, write it, and it's perfect. Yes.
How was your papa? He also didn't do any notes.
No, he just spoke. And then they would, I mean, as you see many times, many times introductions to books are just transcriptions of his lectures, mm. and they work so perfectly, yeah. like that. I mean, that's special. But, okay.
In Madhva Sampradaya, I heard from devotees that they edited that part when Brahma stole.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't accept that part. So it's just, you know, that's, they have a problem because Brahma is the head of the Sampradaya. So how can he be illusioned? This, that, blah.
So it's not there.
It's just
Bhagavan.
Not there. Oh, no, okay. It's just not there. But the point is what's being pointed out is Brahma, though he's the supreme, still he can be illusioned by the Lord. Because it's not a problem, because in that Leela, then even Balaram, he's covered by Krishna's yoga maya.
So it took him for a while.
Yeah, it means he knows something's up, but he can't quite tell what, you know, like that. But that's the difference. No, everybody else, they can't tell that anything's going on, right? But Balaram, you know, because he's God, so he can figure out something's going on, but, you know, like that. Yeah, so then the whole point is it's not a problem. Or like Shiva with the Mohini Murti, you know. Then he's afterwards praising that, you know, I am not overcome by illusion, like that. So his wife there, even if she tries to agitate him, it doesn't bother him, right? But the Supreme Lord was able to agitate him. So then he's pointing out his supremacy. So all these things do is point out the supremacy of Krishna. So the acharyas don't take that as a fault. They just saw how the superiority of Krishna. But somehow or another, in their mind, they don't accept it. You know, I don't think it came from Madhva. I think it came from later. Because you have the known as, when Lord Chaitanya came, so that just as a few hundred years, they're known as the Tattvavadis. So Tattvavadis, then they kind of, their philosophy slightly, they get right into Tattva, but they... When it says that there are different kinds of souls, right? So different kinds of souls means there's illusioned, there's liberated, and then also, because they make three, there's fortunate. We'll probably come across that. Means fortunate just means that they're conditioned, so they fit into that category. So when we give that, there's two. But they're ones who've come in contact with Krishna consciousness. So they're fortunate, and that now they're progressing towards being liberated, right? But the Tattvavadis take it that there's three kinds of souls means there's souls in goodness, passion, and ignorance. Mm. Means that they're eternally in that. So that's why Madhvas don't preach. Because you don't have to. Because souls in the mode of goodness will just naturally come forward at some point. In the modes of passion and ignorance, doesn't matter. You preach them, it's not going to happen. You know. So that's just where that came from, who started that, we have no idea. I'm sure that you can, you know, take it back and find out. But it's one of those things that's... That part is basically unfortunate. So that's why we don't align ourselves with them. Well, you know, means everybody added something to the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So from the Madhvas, it's that the Krishna is the supreme person. Because like in Ramanuja, then it's Vishnu. You know, so Krishna is the supreme person. That's coming from Madhva Sampradaya. But like concepts of festivals and association, big association of devotees, that comes from, and Vaishnava etiquette, that comes from Ramanuja. So like, yeah.
So the Madhvas got the philosophy wrong.
They have, basically it's all right, but certain aspects, that aspect is not very strong.
So how can the chit potency still be there?
It works in whatever else is working.
So my question yesterday was, how do we define when something becomes upper sampradaya?
Well, it's not in line with the authority.
But that's not in line with...
Yeah, so that means that aspect is, but the other parts are correct. You know what I'm saying?
I'm just trying to figure out at what point would we then say, okay, this is bogus, you know?
Well, that aspect is bogus, but the point is everything else is fine. So that impacts upon their preaching. Like that. It means there's only of all their acharyas, there's only one who preaches. Mm. And that's the one who's, they were connected kind of closely with us. Mm. Right? In fact, so much that his junior, he wanted to learn English. Mm. So the devotees taught him through Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada's Gita.
Mm,
so he learned English very nicely, but in there he learned the importance to preach. So he actually went out and preached, and because of that he was ostracized from the line.
Okay.
He couldn't be the junior. So then he says, okay, see you later.
Yeah.
he went to America and opened centers and started preaching.
God.
So
Sahajas would still have something also that's correct.
Well, the thing is their relationship with the Lord is still correct. The Sahajas, mm-hmm. the problem is the relationship with the Lord, and that's not working because it's like this. When you have a spiritual form, you can interact with Krishna, but you actually have to have it.
Mm.
So Raganuga means that you're remembering the spiritual activities or the spiritual service of the liberated devotees,
mm.
what they're doing for Krishna. Right? So they go and fetch some water, or they give Krishna a bath, or dress him, like that. So, but if you're on the platform of Bhava, then in your spiritual form, you can do that.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? But the Sahajiyas imagine, I'm going and getting water, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. So that's bogus. So that process won't work. So therefore, it's not a viable process. Their process, the relationship between the living entity and the Lord, is fine. The process of devotion is fine. But they understand, the point is their point is only the sattvic ones will be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they don't even worry about the others. So basically, that the goodness, passion, ignorance of the soul, they don't really discuss it or worry about it. It's just one of those points they bring up. If you ask them why they don't preach, that's what they'll say.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So yeah.
So the sahajas, that's actually spiritual verbal cognition.
Yes, spiritual verbal cognition. They just come up with some ideas of how they're going to do all these nice things and how wonderful it is. And it's completely made up. I mean, when we get into the Upa Sampradayas, and we'll see. You know, they get strange.
So then when Mahaprabhu just started Tattva Varis, at that point they were already following the line.
They had already, something was not exactly in the line of that Madhva. You know, like that. But it's just like what we said before. Even if what it means not saying that it is, but even if one was counting that there's a serious problem there. But the point is they're following something that has some aspect that's based on the Vedas as in support of. So therefore, it's still progressive. You know, just like we're saying, any religion or anything where there's restriction in that, there's some element of progression. But it's just how much is it nicely situated. You know what I'm saying? Because even you take the neophyte devotee is, there's so much elements that are progressive, but the part that's not pure devotion, that's the part that's not progressive. Does that make sense? Right? So then you're going to have that difficulty. So that aspect of that having that material mix is a pretty regular element within the conditioned soul.
Mm.
But the point is if it's in the parampara, you're following the instructions properly, it's progressive.
But it would also mean that particular point would stick around because you're associating with people who have the same...
Yeah, so that's why spot. Means if you have another alternative, you avoid that.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So therefore, then sometimes it's there, like Prabhupada will say, certain books, like Prabhupada will say, the books, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur that were printed before this time, those are fine. The ones printed afterwards, then you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
The ones done by this group are okay. The ones done by that group, you don't even bother.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty. So then they'll mention, the acharyas will mention what's proper, what's not. There are 11 Upanishads which are sattvika. The Isha, Kena, Kata, Prashna, Mundaka, Mandukya, Taittiriya, Aitreya, Chandogya, Brihad Aranyaka, and Svetasvatara. A few tapanis, extremely healthy with deity worship. So you have Nrisingha tapani and Gopal tapani. and so on are also included. They are the Gopaltapani Upanishad, Nisringatapani Upanishad, etc. Parallel literature of the Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva Vedas are also bona fide. They are dissertations on the Vedas, known as the Brahmanas, Mandalas, etc. All these scriptures have been authorized by the previous Acharyas and are thus accepted as Pramanas, having been authenticated by the liberated souls. Right, so now we're talking within the Veda itself, so then you can tell what's what.
Yeah.
Because sometimes then people, they'll do something to establish, you know, their own principle. Have you ever heard of a book that's something like Advaita something? Advaita Prakash. Now, I've heard from some of the Gaudiyas that the smartest in Shantipur, because they were trying to put in some of their stuff, then they put together the Advaita Prakash so that they could put in some of their own philosophy like that. So many of the Gaudiyas don't deal with that work like that. Because if you know what the points are, then it's not a problem. You know, because like that. But if you don't know what the points are, then you'll just take them along with the rest of them. So in other words, leaving those, then the rest of it's okay. Right? But the problem is that they're trying to bring in their own philosophy. Vrajanath, what is the proof that logic and rhetoric have no jurisdiction in the realm of spirituality? Right? Because otherwise that's what his whole process is. Right? Raghunath Das Babaji, here are quotes from the scriptures. In the Katha Upanishad 1-9 it is said, O Nachiketa, now you have attained the transcendental consciousness of self-knowledge. Do not squander it through the tarka, logic of dry empirical debates. Right? Here's an outstanding quote from the Vedas, giving further proof. Brahma Sutra 2.1.11. Tarka pratishtanat. Contentious rhetoric and empirical logic are unable to extract the correct conclusions from the scriptures. The conclusions established through the logic and argument by one scholar today are certainly refuted and dismembered by the next day. The next day. Hence, logic and rhetoric have been disqualified. Have you noticed the fun part here? There was one word, and it took paragraph to translate it. That's Vedanta Sutra.
Yeah.
So that's why commentary is necessary. Because otherwise, you have one word, and then what it means. I think that I remember, I can't remember, it's how many pages it is, but some very large amount of pages, like 14 or some kind of pages. Atato Brahma Jigyasa, three words, but there's 14-page commentary. Like that. All those first 11, I think, sutras, then basically cover all the philosophy, and everything else is getting into detail. So that's like the summary. And for many, I think Ramanuja, he puts all of his commentary into those 11. Like that. And then I think some even do it in four, like that. So it's means there's a lot packed into these few words like that. Here is further in Mahabharata, Bhishma Parva 5:22. That which is beyond material nature and thereby outside the parameter of sense perception is the inconceivable absolute truth. Therefore, why attempt the impossible and endeavor to approach it through empirical arguments? Vrajana, respected Babaji Maharaj, I have now properly understood that the Vedas are the self-perfected Praman, whose philosophical authority is contested by the logicians to no avail. Kindly tell me the second shloka of the Dasamula doctrines. Right? So now he's satisfied that the Veda is the authority, and these other processes are only in support of, and through logic and argument, you cannot know the absolute truth. Right? Does that make sense? It means if you're discussing what's given by Praman, by the authority of the Veda, and discussing that to bring out the meaning, that's fine. But it's not that through logic, without the authority of the Veda, that you'll find it. But,
Yes. It's interesting, he accepted it so fast. had been doing this his whole life. To no avail?
He's smart. See, the thing is if someone's actually looking for the, you know, something superior, and they spend their whole life looking for it, when they do come across it, they accept it. You know, we see also, it means Vaishnav Das and everybody, means if that means they're just very sincere, so it works quite quickly. Like, but you have to remember, this is the second conversation. Come on. Yeah, come on. You had to go think about it all night, come in the morning, back again, you know, like that. Yeah. I mean, Madhudvisa, he was going along, you know, bumped into the Rath Yatra. He'd never met devotees, thought this is great, took his backpack, threw it up on the cart, went with the whole thing, and when they got to the end, stayed with the devotees, took prasad, went back to the temple, and that was it. So it happens. You know, and then there's those who argue and argue for years. No, no, but, you know, and come back next week with a new argument and all that. Yeah. Yeah. A little more halava, but, you know. That. That's the point being made, is that it can be done in a moment. Right, so here's just examples of everything running very smoothly. But you have all the different kinds. See, much of the time what will happen is somebody's very sincere, then in this one area, then they'll surrender. But much of the time what we'll have is all these different areas going on at once. You know? So that's what slows it down. But, you know, here his only problem is, you know, logic, you know, or someone else's only problem, you know, like that, so. Okay. Raghunath Das Babaji. Here the Dasamula, second verse. The Supreme Lord, Sri Hari, who is worshipped by Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Lord Indra, and other great personalities, is alone the one absolute truth. The Brahman is impotent and impersonal, the bodily effulgence of Sri Hari. Paramatma, the Supersoul, the universal controller, who is omnipresent throughout the material creation, is merely the partial expansion of Sri Hari. The Supreme Personality, Sri Hari, is our dearest Lord, the most beloved of Srimati Radhika, the embodiment of spiritual ecstasy, with a complexion that flouts the beauty of fresh monsoon clouds. Okay. Okay, so here it brings out Brahman, shows that it's is the bodily effulgence of the Lord. Paramatma is the partial expansion of the Lord. Right? So we've dealt with all, but it's Krishna himself, Sri Hari himself, the personality of Godhead. He's the supreme. Right?
Is that the first?
Yes, this is the first Praman. So now we're dealing this in the Sambandha. It means you can say also Praman is Sambandha Tattva, because your knowledge of Pramaya must be based on Praman. So yeah. But you would calculate that this would be now of what is proven, which is Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana. Within Sambandha, this is the first. Right? So the seven Pramayas in Sambandha, one in Abhideya, one in Prayojana. Right in the Dasamo. Rajanath. The Upanishads have declared that Brahman is transcendental to this material nature and is the highest absolute truth. Therefore, kindly explain to me what argument Sri Gaurhari Chaitanya has put forward to establish that Brahman is the bodily luster of Sri Hari. Right? Because they'll establish that Brahman is the supreme. And so now the question comes up is then, okay, but now you're saying that the personality of Godhead, this Brahman that we say is supreme, is his bodily effulgence. Right? Raghunath Das Babaji. Sri Hari is the supreme personality of Godhead. The following statement from the Vishnu Purana. (6.5.47) enumerates the qualifications of his divinity. One who possesses all these six divine and inconceivable excellences known as Bhaga, to the utmost degree, namely opulence, power, fame, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, thus known as Bhagavan. That is in the Vishnu Purana. Okay. These six qualities are inseparably connected, like the body and its limbs. However, which of them is the body and which of them are the limbs? Body means that which is the resting place of the limbs. For example, the tree trunk is the body, and the branches, twigs, and leaves are the limbs of the tree. Similarly, the human torso is the body, and the arms and legs are the limbs of the body. Of the Lord's qualities, unlimited beauty is the very nature of the transcendental form of the Lord, and thus the principal quality, forming the body of which all other qualities are the extended limbs. In this way, opulence, power, fame become the three main limbs of the Lord's beauty. Right? So opulence, power, and fame, because with the body and his beauty, then comes the opulence, the power, the fame, everything that comes along with it. So these are the main ones of beauty. Right?
You think that power was more like kind of a shakti or a potency?
No, but then the power to do things, the ability to perform any things,
comes from beauty? Or have I misunderstood?
Because it's the body that's beautiful.
Mm.
Right? Heard that one before. You know what I'm saying? So that's the main quality, because these others are coming from that, because the opulence is expressed through the body.
Yes.
Right? It means power is expressed through the body. What was the... That's when the fame comes from what has been done with that power and opulence from the body, or even just the fame of the beauty.
Mm, yes.
He's famous for his beauty.
Yes. Makes sense.
Right, you know, famous for his opulence, you know, like that. His power is his opulence. His fame is opulence, you know, like that. His beauty is, so, okay. Like that, yeah. But beauty is the central, because otherwise one could take it as opulence is the central.
Yeah.
Right, that that's the, or his power, he's God, you know, like that. Like that. But the point is it's actually beauty is the central. Because we're talking about, because power and all that is there, power is there in Paramatma.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you have those elements that there's a problem with that there. So the beauty is the actual point. Okay. And from this quality of fame, the subordinate and related qualities of knowledge and renunciation radiate as the Lord's effulgence. So knowledge and renunciation are the Lord's effulgence. Those are subordinate coming from fame. Right? So fame is subordinate to beauty. And then from fame has come knowledge and detachment. Right?
Yeah.
Therefore, Brahman is the effulgence of the entire creation and of the Lord's transcendental form. Perception of this radiant Nirvikar Brahman, that is the supreme without activity and transformation. Because that's what they're attracted to, right? Those who are into Brahman are attracted by knowledge and detachment.
Mm.
Right? So that's the whole point, is that that's what's radiating from the body. So therefore, Brahman is the brilliance of the entire creation and of the Supreme Lord's transcendental form. Perception of this radiant Nirvikar Brahman, that is the Supreme without activity and transformation, bestows Brahma-gyan, spiritual knowledge, and thereby Vairagya, material renunciation, because the Nirvikar Brahman is the effulgence of the unlimitedly beautiful body and transcendental abode of the Lord. Thus, this Nirvikar Brahman, being immutable, inactive, incorporeal, and impersonal, is in itself not the perfect absolute source, but the subordinate attribute of the Supreme Lord. It's non-different, so it's the Supreme. It's the Supreme Absolute Truth. But there's still the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? So which is above, which is the source of this Supreme Aspect, this aspect of Absolute Truth. The light of the fire is not the self-accomplished and dynamic principal source, but is solely dependent upon the fire for its existence. Okay, so that's analogy. So that analogy is based on the principle of the Veda. Therefore, it comes out as perfect. Right? Does that make sense? Because there's always a problem in an analogy, because it doesn't perfectly fit. Because you're trying to give an analogy of something spirit, you know, using something a material analogy to explain something spiritual. So there'll always be a weakness. right? Like that. Yeah. So then, but here we see it works perfectly because the light is coming from the fire. So the form of the fire, right, that is actually the source of the light and the heat. Right? It's not that the light and then you get the, it goes the other way. No, it's coming from that. Right? But where there is light, then there's fire. Right? Does that make sense? Rajanath, kindly tell me how the Paramatma is a partial expansion of the Supreme Godhead. Okay, so we got that. So how this is working? Okay, so Brahmana means, Bhagavan means he has all the six opulences. Of that, beauty is the main. And then fame, power, and opulence are expansions of that. Now, expanding from fame comes knowledge and renunciation. That formless aspect, that is, therefore, because knowledge and detachment don't have the specific. The power of fame, there's more. That's what's being done with the body, right? The others are moods. So they don't really quite have the same, like that. But, so that, therefore, you get Brahman. So now he's going to explain, now how do you get Paramatma from this? Draganath Das Babaji. The Supreme Lord conducts the work of creation of this material cosmos through the agency of two of his potencies, opulence and power. Right? So opulence and power, then you're getting the creation. Mm-hmm. And from fame, you got knowledge and detachment. Right? Very scientific, right? But very simple.
Very interesting.
Yeah. He then enters his creation in the form of his partial expansion for Sri Vishnu, and notwithstanding remains the complete whole in all aspects. Therefore, Sri Vishnu, pervading and controlling this material world, is the Paramatma and the supreme progenitor. Right? So I got that. So now it's not that any of the other acharyas will have a problem with this, even if they were saying that Vishnu, because they're not taking Paramatma as supreme. So when they say Bhagavan, they'll mean Vishnu and Vaikuntha. Right? And then his expansion is, and they won't have a problem that beauty is the main, because it means these prayers, like you've heard this prayer, Madhuram, Madhuram, like this. That's coming from the Sri line. Right? So it's... I think it's even done by Yamunacharya. I think he's got his prayer. So that beauty of the Lord, they'll take also as the essential point. So they'll have no problem. It's the same explanation. All it is they will stop at Vishnu in Vaikuntha as the origin, and then Krishna in Vrindavan is the expansion of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. So that's all. Because he's so opulent, he has these pastimes, rather than, no, this is the original pastime, and because of opulence, then he's expended the others. Like that. The potency Sri Mahavishnu manifests in his glance, which impregnates and pervades the entire material nature, and is personified in the form of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. The entire mass of conditioned jivas, who are infinitesimal parts and parcels of Sri Mahavishnu, are also produced by his transcendental glance. Garbhodakshaya Vishnu then, are also produced by his transcendental glance, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Then, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu accepts the minuscule size of a thumb, or even smaller, and enters the heart of every jiva as Paramatma. In this form, he is known as Kirodakshaya Vishnu, who is thus a partial expansion of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Both the jiva soul and Paramatma, the latter also known as Hiranyagarbha, reside simultaneously within the heart of the material body of the jiva, like two birds upon the same branch of a tree. Right. So here we're taking the potency Shiva. That potency of Mahavishnu, his glance by which he creates, that's personified as Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Right? And then Garbhodakshaya Vishnu expands and he enters into everything as Kirodakshaya Vishnu. Right? So it's the same person, just three different forms of aspects, because then you have Mahavishnu Sankarshan, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is Prajumna, and Kirodakshaya Vishnu is Aniruddha. Right? And then the Leela avatars, that will be Vasudeva. Because right, they come to perform the past, nice pastimes. Okay? So here also then, they're manifesting from Mahavishnu, the souls, right? Because they're coming in his glance. It means the souls are always there, but they're manifesting through the glance, right? And then going into the external, means into the Hiranyagarbha, right? So here you see is that these names are much of the time interchangeable. Paramatma is also known as Hiranyagarbha. Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is known as Hiranyagarbha because he's filling up that. Does that make sense? The creative potency is Hiranyagarbha. So in Mahavishnu, Hiranyagarbha is, because Vishnu means, in this case, means the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer. So creator is Hiranyagarbha. So that expands as Brahma, the demigod, right? Then the destroyer is Sadashiva, right? Like that. Because also in that glance you get Sadashiv, because it's in ignorance that the living entities are going into the material energy, right? Mm. So it's false ego that is gone. So therefore that aspect of tamasi is there. That's what's making the transformation in the ego. Right, because we're saying that something creates that transformation. That transformation is ignorance, right? Means, or a false ego, right? So that's the basis by which then the transformation takes place, and then one falsely identifies with it, right? The material energy. So all these aspects, it's one person. It's just different offices within it. Does that make sense? Right. So that's why they're interchangeable. Like you, it means talking about, there's a prayer to Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, where all the prayers are all, if you didn't know that it was the Hiranya, and it's called the Hiranyagarbha Shukta, right? It's about Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, but it's all the things you're talking. It appears like Shiva, like that. So that's why people get confused. If you don't have the parampara, you don't understand how these things function. Vrajana, thank you. I have now understood that Brahman is the bodily luster of Sri Hari and that Paramatma is the partial expansion of Sri Hari. Now kindly show me the scriptural evidences that Sri Hari is Sri Krishna. Right? Because otherwise, okay, now we've established Vishnu, you know, as Bhagavan is the supreme, but now established that this supreme is Krishna himself. Right? Because that's the other, because you're establishing all this from Vishnu. Right? Like that. So now show how this Vishnu, his origin is Sri Krishna. Raghunath Das Babaji. The Supreme Lord eternally manifests his two spiritual moods simultaneously, Aishwarya and Madhurya. In his Aishwarya manifestation, he is Sri Narayana, Lord of the Vaikuntha planets, and the fountainhead of all the Vishnu expansions. In his Madhurya manifestations, he is Sri Krishna, embodying the highest perfection of Madhurya. In fact, the intensity of Madhurya manifest in Sri Krishna thoroughly covers any trace of his Aishwarya. In terms of philosophy, Sri Narayan and Sri Krishna are non-different. Yet, in the consideration of transcendental rasa, Sri Krishna is the source and repository of all such rasa, and as such, he is therefore the highest and most relishable among all spiritual truths. Right? So in other words, he's established that we tend to take it, Vishnu is one thing, Krishna is another. But actually in tattva, they're the same person. The difference in the person is the rasa. Right? So the point is Krishna is the supreme because the manifestation of rasa is so much greater. Right? So that's the whole point. But they're the same person. So it's not that this one's supreme, this one, they're all the same person. So the point is all the rasa, the reservoir of rasa, is the source of one rasa, you know, servitorship. Mm. Right? Yes.
I was speaking to someone who claims to be Hindu, and he had difficulty accepting that Krishna is the supreme personality, because Krishna is the original supreme, and then from him comes...
Yeah, that means you have that. It means it's not wrong. But it's at the same time as there's also a difference. See, now if you're looking at it in general, in a day of Brahma, then Swayam Krishna, means Krishna from Braja Vrindavan, Goloka, comes once in a day of Brahma. That means out of 1,000 cycles, Dwapara Yugas, He comes once. That means 999 are actually take the mood of Vishnu, who's expanded as Krishna. Does that make sense? So it's not wrong to say Krishna's expanded, but they don't understand. They're going by tattva. But the point is when you're dealing with rasa, because there is no difference between Krishna and Vishnu. They're the same person. Just like the high court judge in the office, you know, in court, and the high court judge at home are the same person, but there's a total difference in mood. Right? Does that make sense? But the mood at home, that's the original. Right? Then that expands into him in the court. But those other ones that they're talking about are expanding from there, from Vishnu, because they're Vishnu. Vishnu means they're expansions of the mood of Vishnu, and they're coming and performing these pastimes. Does that make sense? But Swayam Krishna, that's different, because there is that mood is original, because we're saying that he had all those five rasas are there. Let's say we acknowledge that there's five rasas, okay? Means, okay, one, it, for those who are interested in Vishnu, they're only interested in servitorship, right? But they have to acknowledge that Rama is there, he has parents. Krishna's in Dwarka, they'll accept those pastimes. He has parents, he has friends, he has wives, he has so many things. So it's much more expanded. Right? Because in Vaikuntha, you have servitorship. Even Lakshmi is taken in the mood of, she's the head servitor. Means they'd have to acknowledge, yes, it's a conjugal relationship, but it's not prominent at all. That prominence of the kanta is not seen. It's just, it's always in that mood of servitorship. So one would have to say is, but these rasas are all there. So that means that full manifestation of that is the complete personality of Godhead. Then, where you only expand certain rasas to certain degrees, that has to be expansions of that. You understand? But it's not a problem, because it's the same person. Because Vishnu is Krishna. Krishna is Vishnu, as far as tattva goes. It's the same person. The difference is in rasa. So we're discriminating based on rasa, because rasa is the most important. Right? Does that make sense? But as far as tattva, there's no difference. So on tattva, we don't have a problem. So all these problems that come up from rasa, you can work out by simply bringing it to tattva. You know, like Krishna and the gopis are dancing, that's immoral. But in tattva, it's just his internal potency. So they're eternally, you know, they're non-different. So there's not a problem if Krishna dances with his own potency. You know, from that angle, okay, that's cool. You know, so you have to say it's because they're connected, it's actually a parakeya. But it's taking on the mood of, I mean, it's actually swakeya, but they're taking on the mood of parakeya. So then those that have a problem with that will accept that. Does that make sense? But you have to do it from tattva. So from a tattva, you can work out these problems. Because it depends on their appreciation of rasa, what they are comfortable with. Is that make sense? Yeah, no, the point is, it's because we have the authority of the Veda, now we're using logic to establish that. Does that make sense? Right, so logically we go through and show one, then the next, to the next, to the next, and it works out very, very nice. Yeah? So that's why it's there. But to just go through logic, you could put the logic through so many different forms and angles you could do. And so then you come up with, that's where speculation comes up. You know, but fame comes, you have power, you have fame. You know, or you have this and that, you have fame. Or if you have knowledge, you have fame. You know, because they're all non-different, but at the same time, there is a natural order to them. So unless that order is given, you would never know. So the point is God gives that order. Then you know. That's how we know Shankya with 24 elements, that's what we use as our primary system. Because others talk about 30, I think it's 32, like that. There's 16, there's 9. There's so many ways, because they just take things and fold them up into the other. But then 24 pulls things out enough that it's very nicely able to be appreciated. But not so much it starts getting crazy, because then you have, you know, what is it, you know, lust, anger, you know, greed, envy, attachment, and illusion. But those are modifications of the mind. Mm. So they're already included in mind, but some expand those as part of the creation, because even in the Bhagavatam it goes through, it brings those out as major elements. Right? So they're major sub-elements. But some will count those as main elements, so then they'll end up with, you know, with 30 there. And then they add in some more, so this and that, it goes on. I mean, may even, I kind of remember someone saying, some classified as 48. Hmm. But then it gets too complicated. So 24 is the nice amount. It's very easy because it means the earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego, right? Then the senses, the sense objects, right? The tanmatras, you know, like this. Then it works out very nicely. The modes of nature, you're done because that's what you're working with. Now, subtle points of those, then how everything expands, right? So Lord Chaitanya has accepted that one. So that means this is the prominent one, right? Not that the others are wrong. The other ones are just in a particular thing you don't want to get into, let's say, the sense of sense objects and tanmatras. You just say the mind. Right? So then you just have to have one. Right? And then it takes care of 16. Does that make sense? You know, so like that, it works out. Okay. The Supreme Lord eternally manifests his two spiritual moods simultaneously, Aishwarya and Madhurya. In his Aishwarya manifestation, he is Sri Narayan, Lord of the Vaikuntha planets. Because as Bhagavan, he manifests the opulences, right? But then in Madhurya, opulence isn't the main manifestation, right? It's just the personality. Like, no, he has. That's the fun part. You take it, okay, then he manifests it more. But no, it's manifest in a way, it's the person of the sweetness comes out. In his Aishwarya manifestations, he is Sri Narayan, Lord of the Vaikuntha planets, and the fountainhead of all the Vishnu expansions. In his Madhurya manifestation, he is Sri Krishna, embodying the highest perfection of Madhurya. In fact, the intensity of Madhurya manifest in Sri Krishna thoroughly covers any trace of his Aishwarya. It means thoroughly covers. It means you don't even notice it. Right? Because when we think of opulence, you think of Vaikuntha. We don't think of Vrindavan as opulent. But it's way more opulent. Right? One speck of dust manifests all the opulence of the Vaikuntha planets. But no one in Vrindavan worries about opulence. It's so much more opulent. Right? But no one worries about it. It's all, because it's covered by the sweetness. The sweetness is so great, you don't worry about the opulence.
Yeah, and if you have enough of it, you don't really worry about it.
Yeah, like that, you know.
It's like old money. They don't really care about it.
Yeah, yeah. Like I remember we went going by a shop in Dubai, and they have this trunk about this big. And, you know, it's open, and it's just full of sweets. Seriously expensive sweets. Right? And one box means that was a few years ago. Now it probably costs more. But then it costs $3,000 a box. Right? And why we're thinking, wow, how often do you sell those? He says, no, generally we do an average of one a day. Yeah. You know, sometimes in some seasons more. But one a day, they sell. You know, so the stuff on the shelf, people coming in buying two sweets, five sweets, that's, you know, just on the side, you know. They sell trunks, right? So that's what you're saying. The old money, the opulence gets side, you know, for the appreciation of the sweetness, yes. Right? Yeah, so no one worries about how much it costs, right? You know, so it's
serious.
Yeah. I don't want to make you feel bad that you thought you had a lot of sweets, you know.
No. I have to rethink my diet, maybe.
Maybe you need to get yourself a trunk for your halava instead of a bucket.
Actually, I have a trunk, but there's books in it. Maybe I could rearrange some.
Yeah, okay. In terms of philosophy, Sri Narayan and Sri Krishna are non-different, right? So when discussing tattva, they're non-different. So Prabhupada would get upset if devotees would make too much of a distinction between Krishna and Narayan, because they're the same person. See, it's one thing of discussing a difference in rasa, but when you make it a difference as a person, then, oh, no, no. He's the same person. Just he's only manifesting that much, because Krishna says, as you surrender, I reciprocate, right? So they're surrendering to him in servitorship, in opulence, and so he's reciprocating that way. It's the same. Like that. Even if Sri Krishna was there, they deal with him like that, therefore he reciprocates that way. So then he's Vishnu. Right? But you deal with him on the platform of the sweetness, then he manifests as Krishna. Yes?
Also, people have to say that they say that Vishnu is first, but this is in material creation because in the spiritual world, Krishna is first in the Radha.
Yeah. Because Mahavishnu is first, so he's Narayan. But then he's expanding from Sankarshan in the spiritual world. You have Mahanarayan, but they don't take it back so far. They get back to Mahanarayan and stop. Okay. You had a question? You had a question, didn't have a question. Don't remember you had a question. Okay. Yet, in the consideration of transcendental rasa, Sri Krishna is the source and repository of all such rasa, right? Because if you're looking at it as rasa, they're the same person, so it's not that one is first and the other. It's that they're the same person, but the aspect of which manifestation of the Lord is first, then it's the full aspect of rasa, because that's the complete aspect, right? And then Vishnu is, you're only manifesting a part of that rasa. So it would be natural that manifestation is second. But as Vishnu, that means the Supreme Lord is first, right? So then as Aishwarya is Vishnu, as Madhurya is Krishna. Does that make sense? Sri Krishna, yet in the consideration of transcendental rasa, Sri Krishna is the source and repository of all such rasa, and as such he is therefore the highest and most relishable amongst all spiritual truths. In the Gopal Tapani Upanishad, Purva 21, we read, Eko Vashi Sarvaga Krishna Idya Eko Pisan Bahuda Yo Vabhati. Sri Krishna is the only Supreme Personality who can bring every being under his sway. He is the absolute Brahman, omnipresent and without a second, and the divine object of the worship of everyone. Although he is singular, yet by the power of his inconceivable potency, he manifests himself in a myriad of forms and thus performs unlimited variegated pastimes. Vrajana. Sri Krishna possesses a medium-sized form, so how can he be sarvaga, all-pervasive? If we accept the fact that he has a form, it automatically presupposes that he is restricted to one place. This reveals certain philosophical discrepancies. Firstly, if through having form he is restricted to one place, this inhibits his potency of being omnipresent. Secondly, by having a body, he would be forced to be under the subjugation of the three material modes, and therefore his absolute freedom and authority would be impinged upon. How can these contradictions be reconciled? Right? So here's the difference. Is when he's first coming, before he surrenders, then it's a matter of, he sees contradictions. Ah, here's a fault. This is where I can win my argument. Now, because he's intelligent, he's logical, then he thinks, okay, now if you've established this next fact, right? Because you're establishing one fact at a time. And as you establish it, that's where the doubts come up. Right? If there's no fact, there's no doubt. Right? So as you establish the next one, there's natural doubt. So he's intelligent enough to know what the logical next doubt would be. But now he's asking, how do you reconcile this? He's seeing it. He doesn't understand it. But now he's asking, okay, how do you reconcile this? Right? So one is he's intelligent enough to see the point, but he's more intelligent that he sees that there's no problem here. He just doesn't understand it. In other words, for the Nyayist, if I don't understand it, it's not right, right? Unless he's very sincere. But here, for the sincere inquirer, is I don't understand it means the authority knows. So I don't understand, so please explain it. Right? Does this make sense? Raghunath Das Babaji, my son, you have allowed yourself to be trapped by mundane logic and rationalization, right? Because he's naturally just taking it. Okay, form comes from the modes of nature. Form means you're restricted to one place. You know, so how can he be all pervasive or all you know, omnipotent? How all these different things he's come up with, because he's compared it to the material, right? He could have just listened and go, okay, well, these are just the spiritual qualities. And then the conditioned soul, he has all these problems, but he doesn't understand spiritual form, right? Like that. So therefore, he immediately gives form means material, then those material has these restrictions therefore go on form.
Right. Similar to the Muslim who was...
Yes, similar to the Muslim. Same problem. Means the point is karma and jnana, which are mundane concepts, then those pervade everything. If it's not, how you say, if it's not Vedanta, it's not actually fully spiritual. Right? So... No, it's a quote from Tweedledee. Yeah. Maybe Tweedledum. Right, so the point is this.
I don't think that was on the list of bona fide scriptures.
No, it's not there. It's not there. So the point is this. Anything else is covered by karma and jnana. So therefore there'll be similarity.
Yeah.
Like that. So that's why you're going through the same thing. Like we discussed this before, but we're going through it from a slightly different perspective. Right. In other words, we're going through it for someone who doesn't have the authority of the Vedas. Now we're going through it with someone who has the authority of the Vedas. But at the same time, we go through another thing that of the with logic and stuff you can do. So there's different ways depending upon the person how you go through it. So all we're doing is dealing with them from all these different angles. Right, but now we've come to the point of someone who's accepting these scriptures and is working on that scripture. So now that question, because you saw before, is that basically they came to the point where they're satisfied, but they didn't take it any further. We saw nobody else came back, right? You know, the same acharyas are there, sitting here in Godroom, but they're not coming back and asking more. They're simply, okay, we don't have an argument with them. So we do what we do, they do what they do, and we, you know, everybody's happy. But here we see is the person came with the same mentality. But after being convinced, he decided to come back and actually learn. Right? So now this is a different one. Just like we see in the beginning, Vaishnav Das and Lahiri Babu. They came, but then they took up. But it was more of the practices, you know, and the basic kind of things. It was there to establish. In other words, that much is how much you need to make someone a devotee, right? So those aspects of preaching is what you require. Now, if you get into somebody who's more into philosophy, or within devotional service, they have these doubts left from before. Now these things are being covered. Does that make sense? So then, all the different levels of devotional development are being covered, right? Because at one point we get to the more advanced level, and then we'll deal with that, and then get to the highest levels. Okay. My son, you have allowed yourself to be trapped by mundane logic and rationalization, so doubts cloud your mind, right? So that's the point why you were saying before, it's through logic and that you can't understand. So what's happened? He's allowed logic to catch he can't understand. It's not that it's not logical. It means we see that it's very logical how the philosophy unfolds. It's tattva. It has to be logical. But it's not through logic that you can understand it. Mm-hmm. See, that's the fun part. You think it's logical, I can understand it through logic. No. It's logical, you have to understand it through faith. Mm-hmm. Now, you have faith, then you understand the logic. And if you have logic but don't have the faith, you'll never understand it. So it's beyond logic.
So that's why Prabhupada says, first you become a student.
Yes, first you become a student, then you can understand. Because Gita opens that way. Have the proper spirit. Even if you don't accept, just at least as an exercise for the study of the Gita, take that mood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just in theory. Just because if you take intellectually, it is a mathematical option.
Yeah.
That, you know, we could be spirit soul, we could be servants of God. Right, we could in this way be submissive to God. They are mathematically possible. So for the study of Gita, he recommends take this mood. And then from that, study the Gita. Then see if you get the results. If you don't get the results having done that, okay, then do whatever you want to do. But at least if you want to do it, take that mood, right? Because with any activity, the attitude is important. You have the wrong attitude, it doesn't work, right? That's the whole point, is it's attitude that's very, very much important. Okay. However, when we understand that the human-like appearance of the Supreme Lord is completely spiritual, then the discrepancies mentioned by you are done away with, right? Because he said, no, but the modes of nature will do all this. Point is he's not the modes of nature. He's spiritual, spiritual form. So therefore, your problem is that he's limited and is produced by the modes of nature, so all these different problems. That goes away because it's not produced by the modes of nature. Nirakar, formless. Nirvikar, immutability. Niskriya, inactivity, and so on, actually indicate the transcendental nature of Krishna's form, which compromises the spiritual status inherently distinct from the qualities of the perceptible material creation. Therefore, these terms may be taken as retrospectively indicating spiritual qualities through negation. Right? Means here, now as a logician, his problem before is you're not accepting this principle of the negative. Right? But here he's saying if you want to look through negative, means nirakar means he's not materially active. It doesn't mean that he's not spiritually active, because therefore he has to be spiritual, right? Because if we're saying if you're not materially active, then that means you're spiritual. Right? So the point is that In by looking at it in reverse, right, then you would get that. But the point is his form is spiritual. That means these qualities mean that. It means he is inactive materially. Right? He doesn't have material qualities. Right? Formless, nirakar, he has no material form. There's a spiritual form. Because you can say, okay, no, it's Brahman, but the point is if I say there's a spiritual form, there's no material form, nirakar. There's spiritual activities, there's no material activities, so niskriya, right? And what was the other one? Nirvikar.
Nirakar, nirvikara.
Nirakar. Formless, okay. And there's no material form, nirakar. You can't say it's wrong. You can say, no, but that's Brahman. But the point is yes, that's the Supreme Brahman. But you can't say that there's no... We've said that there's spiritual, there's no material form of spiritual. But we've never said there's no spiritual form of spiritual. Right? That they would have to say, yeah, the scriptures don't say that. So the point is that these qualities, they are in the negative referring to... There, so even the scriptures that talk about Brahman and about Mukti, they're actually referring to the spiritual platform, you know, and the spiritual form, the spiritual activities. But people don't catch that because they're not interested. You know, just like the person, the liberation is described, but the person who's interested in karma doesn't notice it. He couldn't care less. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
Therefore, these terms may be taken as retrospectively indicating spiritual qualities through negation. Juxtaposed with them, however, are positive descriptions of Krishna's excellences, such as a bright and beaming face, eyes like lotus petals, the cooling sanctuary of his lotus feet, exquisite and graceful limbs, and so on. Thus, the spiritual form and pure goodness is described. Right? The medium-sized human-like form of Krishna is the embodiment of both kinds of characteristics, form and all-pervasiveness, and is supremely exquisite. So the scriptures describe the nirakar aspects. At the same time, it also describes his lotus face and this and that. So by mundane logic, they're putting it together. Therefore, the form must be material. But if you actually look at it actual logical... If we're saying the Supreme Lord has these qualities. He doesn't have any material activities, no material form, right? And he has a lotus face and lotus eyes and beautiful form. Means that that form is spiritual. Mm. It's not material. That's the actual logic. But because of being clouded by their own intelligence, I mean their concept of their logical intelligence is going to get them everything. Therefore, they can't understand. So that lack of faith, they can't put together two obvious points. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Very excellent presentation, right? So succinct. Very, very excellent. Right? So the medium-sized human-like form of Krishna is the embodiment of both kinds of characteristics, right? It means, in other words, it's the embodiment of the characteristics in the negative because it doesn't have them. And in the positive, you know, the beauty and all that, because it has them. So that's the specialness of God. That's the transcendental. It has both of these. Right? The form of Krishna is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. His form is not tainted by any material qualities, nor does it have even the slightest in common with matter. It is beyond the touch of matter, place, and circumstance. Right? So time, place, and circumstance don't affect Krishna. Right? Shri Krishna is present in fullness everywhere, simultaneously. He is the indivisible embodiment of the non-dual absolute knowledge. In the transcendental world, all the inherent qualities are limitless. So within the medium-sized spiritual form of Sri Krishna, the quality of Sarvaga can nicely reside, even though such a quality certainly cannot exist in a middle-sized item in the material world. Right? So the point is yes, in the material world it can't exist, but in the spiritual world it can. Right? Because anyway, all this is just his expansion and his Brahman effulgence. Mm. Like that, that's coming from the form. So that means he is pervading everything through his Brahman effulgence. Like that. So he is all-pervading. At the same time, is that all-pervasiveness is the effulgence, because he and his effulgence are non-different. So he is pervading everything through his effulgence. And since it's him, then, yeah. Furthermore, unlike all material form, the spiritual body of Sri Krishna is omnipresent, even upon the mundane material level. This is inconceivable mystic potency of the Satchitananda Vigraha of the Lord, who has taught you that whatever possesses a medium-sized form is automatically restricted by the mundane material qualities. As long as your consciousness is polluted by such mundane conceptions, you will be unable to realize the pure spiritual potency of the transcendental form of the Lord, simply because it apparently resembles the human appearance, right? So, who's taught you this, that if it has a form, the spiritual can't have form? Because the point is the Shastras are explaining both. So, Shastra is not going to contradict itself. It's just talking about two different things. If I talk about the person is great and wonderful, and he's a nice person, he interacts very nicely. Same time I say another, he doesn't do anything bad, he's never doing things that shouldn't be done, and things like that. He's never in the wrong place, he's not like that. So that doesn't mean that it's two different people. One doesn't include the other. So the point is all the things in the scripture that define the lack of material qualities, and therefore the omnipotent, omnipresent, and all these kinds of things, don't contradict his spiritual form as beautiful and all at the same time is omnipotent. He can be anywhere at any time. It doesn't contradict. What it means is the material can't do that. So therefore, if he has those qualities, means it's not material. Right? Form has been explained. That means the form is spiritual. Right? So it's only our own conditioning that will say no, form has to mean material. But the scriptures aren't saying that. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so then it's fun. Who taught you that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so even upon the mundane, though, yeah, okay. Vrajanath, respected Babaji, the deity form, bodily luster, pastime, paraphernalia, associates, homes, woods, love groves, etc. of Sri Radha and Sri Krishna are all super mundane, and the intelligent person should not have any doubts regarding the transcendental quality. However, the question that follows is, how do the incarnations of the Supreme Lord manifest the transcendental vigrahas, dhams, and leelas upon the limited mundane platform, right? Because now he left that opening there. Because he said here, furthermore, unlike all material forms, the spiritual body of Sri Krishna is omnipresent, even upon the mundane material level. Right? So he's brought out that the Lord comes here. His deity is transcendental, though we may see it as stone. Right? So the whole thing is now that leaves that open, which gets even more. Because the other one, okay, this and that. But then how do you get into the deity? That was the problem that we had before with the mula.
Yeah.
He had most problem with that. Yeah. Because he's already decided that, therefore, if there's no form, there can be no deity.
Mm.
Right? While the Hindus don't have a problem with the deity, because they know ultimately, they're saying ultimately there's no form.
Mm.
But if you point out that it never says that there is no such thing as spiritual form, right? It says there's no, the spirit doesn't have material form and material qualities, but it doesn't say that spiritual form doesn't exist, right? That's just an overlook on their part, right? You know, you just read into it what you like, right? That's mimamsa, is that you interpret it how you want the results, right? So, therefore, then that means it goes just the very natural is, okay, I have senses and mind, I can't focus on Nirakar. So therefore I have to have something that my senses and mind can relate to. So I have form, so I have the deity. So the deity is bona fide process to elevate myself. Now, but the problem is then they come to the point is that they give up the deity worship and come to the platform of Brahman. Right? So then that means they're not actually devotees. Right, because devotee means on the spiritual platform you interact with the form of the Lord. Right, so now, but now once it's understood, right, it's understood and appreciated that the form of the Lord is eternal, and that's actually real. Then now their deity worship instead of being a temporary process in their sadhana to get the sadhya of mukti or liberation. Now that temporary sadhana turns into permanent, becomes into nitya, that there is eternal worship of the eternal form of the Lord. Does that make sense? But now the difficulty is when you have religious processes outside of the Vedic process, then they don't accept that there can be, since there's no material form, there can be no deity. Right, so even if you establish the spiritual form of the Lord, okay, so even we say, okay, if you're going to go to heaven, you're going to walk with God, that means God's got to have legs, right? And if he doesn't have eyes, he'll not bump, how is he going to bump into things? And you want to walk around with a guy who has no arms? No, okay, so, you know, he's got to have arms and a head also.
Yeah.
Okay, so then they may accept that from that, even just taking the logic of their own spirit, because if they're saying that you're going to be with God in the same time as there's no material quality, it means that there must be spiritual form. But then the problem is there's no tradition of deity.
Mm.
Right? You know, of course, that's there to keep them from misapplying mundane, unauthorized deity forms, because that was the popular thing, right? In India, generally, you always use a authorized form, but as soon as you leave the boundary of the Vedic culture, it's like immediately they just make up anything. You know, I mean, it gets wild. You know, it really gets wild, right? So then, that's the problem. You know, so then, therefore, to avoid that, you just say no to all of it. But then, if you are more mature, then you can discriminate. Does that make sense? You know, if the kid can't discriminate between what's a candy and what's poison, then you say, don't eat anything like that. Right? Does that make sense? You know, so therefore then, but if they can discriminate, then they can tell the difference. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's where your more strength and weakness is following the Vedic culture is a better situation religiously than not following it. Because it has more opportunities for the aspects of sadhana to be applied in a wider range. Essence can be applied anywhere, but all these limbs of aspects to help in one's sadhana, then you have much more. Right? Okay. Okay, question. How do the incarnation of the Supreme Lord manifest the transcendental vigrahas, dhammas, and leelas upon the limited mundane platform? Raghunath Das Babaji. For the all-powerful Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, nothing is impossible, and he is always engrossed in performing extraordinary activities. He is self-willed, totally independent, and omnipotent. If he so desires, he can easily manifest his transcendental vigrahas, dhammas, and leelas within the material universe. How can anyone doubt this? Rajanath, truly, if the Supreme Lord wishes to show his purely spiritual self-manifest vigraha, etc., in the material world, he can easily do so, right? Because he's saying if he's omnipotent, he has to be able to do this. You can't say God's omnipotent and say you can't do that, right? That's not right, because that means then you have more potency than he's got, because you said it and he can't do it, right? Because scripture says he's omnipotent, that means he can do it, you know? However, when the people of this world see these manifestations, they generally see the transcendental dham as part of the material topography. This transcendental vigraha, his transcendental vigraha as a material body, and his supramundane leelas as ordinary dealings. If Krishna has bestowed his blessings upon the world by these spiritual manifestations, then why has he excluded the people from developing the necessary transcendental vision to recognize their divine Satchitananda nature, right? Very, very smart. He says, okay, so truly he can do whatever he likes, but now when he does manifest it, people think it's a mundane place, it's a mundane body, and it's mundane activities. So why is it that some people are able to appreciate it, that it is transcendental? It is transcendental, so why is it only some people can appreciate that? Well, the bulk of people don't. Right? So that's his next question. So we'll stop here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Janita Govardhan. So we'll have the... we'll have the class at 10:30. I think the one in the evening, then we won't be able to do, because I have to go somewhere and it's too much to go, come back, and everything. So for today, we just won't have it.
So no evening class today.
Yes, no evening class, but the 10:30 class will have it.